Welcome to the Farcast, bringing you insights into Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thanks so much for joining us again this week. Sorry I've been out a couple weeks, folks. Speeches and traveling and through all of that, and I got to see so many good friends, and one of you good friends gave me a good dose of COVID, so I was out last week, down for the count, the fever, the whole thing. It's out there, folks. Be careful. Today is the seventh day of March. Super Tuesday is in the rearview mirror. We have two. We've never had one end this early, where basically we move to the general election on March 7th or 8th here, but that's what we're doing. Moving to the general election, Joe Biden versus Donald Trump. Each candidate, think about this, each candidate believes that he will win because the other candidate is more despicable than he is. The more other candidates worse, the other candidate is more disliked, and therefore that's how I'm going to get elected. The other guy's worse, so vote for me. How's that for a platform, ladies and gentlemen? Really? Really? And that's where we are. State of the Union tonight. I will watch it. I can't wait to watch it, and I'm dreading it at the same time. I just can't imagine that Joe Biden's going to pull this off. I don't know whether I want something good for the president here or not. If the president comes out as alert and attentive and funny and actually nails this, it means that Joe Biden's the candidate. Really, this is going to lock him in. If he comes out and stumbles and blows this thing and looks old and loses his place, God forbid some aide has to rush up to the podium to help him find the next line, he's out. And then you get a new candidate. And maybe that wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. No disrespect. I have great respect for Joe Biden. Great respect for Joe Biden. Any politician who has spent their lives serving this country, no matter how misguided I may feel they are from moment to moment, that they've done that, they have my great respect and appreciation, really. A year ago, I was at a dinner where Nancy Pelosi was made a member of this organization. There were a bunch of organizations. It was a bipartisan organization. Only time I've ever seen a new member of this organization get a standing ovation from like 500 people out of appreciation for Nancy Pelosi's service. So I disagreed with most of Nancy Pelosi's agenda over her political lifetime. I really did. That's me being personal. But boy, what a politician and how effective she was, even though I disagreed with most of that she did. And I think she deserves our respect and appreciation. Can't we give that much? Jeez. So watching stocks, they keep going up. And I spoke at a Hightower conference yesterday. It was the day with the stars. All of the CNBC talking heads, plus a few more, were there. Really, really smart people. Tom Lee, everybody around the horn. Jason Trennett from Strategast. Kenny Polcari, of course, is going to be with us in segment three today. There was a general tone of caution, and everybody had reasons for why they were bearish on one level or another, but it wasn't a pervasive bearishness. There was a sense that people were talking about the loan portfolios, credit quality, banks. You don't want to invest in banks. Others were saying, yes, you do want to invest in banks. That's kind of normal at these things where really bright people can disagree on this. I said, I came at the end, and Stephanie Link said, Michael, can you wrap this for us? And I said, yeah, I'm hearing the same thing from all of these experienced pros, ladies and gentlemen, all these experienced pros. They're all saying this has been too good for too long. We're waiting for it to snap. We don't know if it's going to be a big snap or a little snap, but we know it's coming. We've just done it too long. We know it's coming. And is it going to be a credit issue? Is it going to be a liquidity issue? There doesn't seem to be a liquidity issue. There's cash everywhere, tons and tons of cash everywhere. Will it be a Fed-driven issue? Will the Fed stay too long? Will this be the mild sort of a pullback? You can call it a recession, call it whatever the hell you want. Will it be a mild pullback and then you're back to the races? What will inspire the Fed to actually ease? We're watching all of those things really closely, and everybody has a different approach, but the consensus was in the sentiment was something, this doesn't last forever, something will happen, that happening will be an opportunity as prices go lower, And then the long-term structural problem of creating so damn much debt, nobody can figure out what to do with it, will linger with us for several years to come. Next year will be the first year that interest payment on the debt will exceed the budget for defense spending in the U.S. Interest spending on the debt, just debt service, will be greater than the Defense Department budget. And it's going up, folks. It's going up. What do markets make of this? We're going to go to Jim Murio, who's been kind of dead on for quite a while in his view of markets. You know, he's a technician, you know, he's a trader, but you know, he also has that cat-like instinct that you need to listen to after all these years. Welcome back, Jim Murio.
Thank you for having me, Michael. It's interesting. You hit on a lot of the themes that I've been focusing on there, except for one. You know, all these smart people, and I have a ton of respect for all those people. Many of them are my friends. But I think that the issue is this, is, well, the issue for the stock market, and again, I was bullish for technical reasons for like the last, call it 6 months, but now I fill in the fundamental reasons in my head. Now you look at, we've talked about reverse repo, right? So everybody should have on their charts every morning, the money that's left in the reverse repo facility. That and I don't mean to get too wonky in the weeds here, but it's very, very important. In May, that amount of money was $2.2 trillion. That was bank reserves, bank deposits that were looking for treasuries. Now, the Treasury has zapped all that liquidity by selling them three-month treasuries and spitting that money back into the economy. That's why M2 money supply has gone up over the last year, not down. So in a period of the Fed quantitative tightening, M2 money supply should be going down. It's not. It's inching back up again. And that's because the Treasury. So the moral of the story here is the government's spending too much money. They found a pool of money that they could liquidate without it being a problem. However, here comes the spoiler, the drum roll. In June or July, that money runs out. At that point in time, the Treasury has to figure out how to sell bonds into an open, unsupported market. The Fed is not going to buy bonds. Well, at least they're not going to at first. I believe they eventually will buy bonds. And as soon as the Fed starts buying bonds, I think two things will happen. I think the stock market is going to crap out to the tune of about 10 or 12%. That's usually what pushes the Fed into an easing cycle. And then I think the dollar will suffer and things like gold, Bitcoin, silver, and then eventually stocks will do well with the added liquidity of the Fed. I know you get that stuff about the reverse repo, but do you think I need to go deeper into that, or does that make any sense?
Jim, I know exactly what you're talking about, of course. Tell us what a repurchase, this is going to be hard. Can you give us a simple explanation of a repurchase agreement? What's a repurchase agreement?
So in the days of old, people come to banks to have deposits. When a bank gets deposits, they have to do something with that money or else they're losing money because they're paying you interest. I know it was a very, very small interest for a long time. So what they do within the banking world, one bank has a bunch of US treasuries, one bank has a bunch of deposits. They swap them for a day or two or three, and then they swap them back. The agreement is to swap them back. That's the repurchase thing too. So it just wants the banks, it's a system to make banks more efficient with the money they hold. But anyway, the Fed stepped into it.
So now let's get this dumb enough so that Farr can understand
sure.
It. You've got $1 million in cash and I've got $1 million in 5% treasury bills. We're going to swap those for two nights. Why would I swap out? Why would I give you my 5% treasury bills for the cash?
Because you need cash. And I need treasuries. Let's say your payments.
I need liquidity over at my bank.
You need liquidity at your bank. I need to put my money to work at my bank. So it's just all it is to match up the different cycles and payroll and deposits that the banks have. So the money's constantly working. Does that make some sense?
Yes, that makes sense. But depending on the supply of how many people out there have more bonds that are trying to get cash or how much cash is trying to get bonds, it could be that I give you a lower return than the 5% I'm getting.
Yes, or so higher, depending on what the general
higher
demand
on the
is
supply
for bands
and
at that time.
Yes,
it's an open market, right?
Demand. So it's a little bit of how do I meet my needs to operate my bank? These aren't really huge, huge deals. And when they go back for reverse repo, that's going to get wonky. But basically, you understand that these are just meeting overnight liquidity needs. Now, in 2008, Jim, when we ran into trouble with these, all of a sudden, it wasn't just treasuries people were giving overnight. They were giving a lot of other securities, and somebody looked up and went, these other securities are crap. They're just
so the Fed had to buy them, right? You get it.
And the Fed then had to step in and buy this stuff because the banks started to get free and loose and do stupid things. Okay. That's all that happens a lot, by the way. When the banks start to go too far into the risk and leave the script, that's when you get into trouble. Go ahead, Jim.
Okay, so now that we taught people, those people who didn't understand that, and I know a lot of you guys who are listening do, let's forget all that and then just think of it as there was $2.2 trillion in the banking system that was looking to buy short-term treasuries. The Treasury knew that and has used that for the last, since May, draining that to support their profligate, drunken sailor spending. That money, that won't last forever. And then I believe there could be some chaos in the market. And that chaos comes in June or July. That's the takeaway, that in June or July, the Treasury has to go out to the regular bond market. And they've had some trouble selling long-end bonds in the last 4 or 5 months. So it's not end of the world type of trouble. But if that starts to look chaotic, I think the Fed comes, well, I think the stock market could break quickly. And it probably will have something to do with regional banks and commercial real estate as well. And then the Fed comes off the sideline and starts adding liquidity again. At that point in time, I think things could do really well, but not before a sharp sell-off in the stock market.
Doesn't it really just beg credulity that you know that, I know that, the world knows that, it's coming in May. Hey, Janet Yellen, maybe you should have a plan. Maybe you should have a plan and not, and you know, end up in some sort of chaotic moment here. I still remember a great friend of mine, Scott Sobel, when he was a television news producer running the news desk. He said every year at this news station, they would be surprised and go into panic over the arrival of Thanksgiving. Oh my God, do you know that it's Thanksgiving next week? We've got to put B-roll together. We've got to get kids in the little turkey outfits. Who the hell's doing? It's going to be Thanksgiving. He said there was an ongoing panic every year for Thanksgiving. Dumbest thing that ever happened. But that's, you know, we're going to panic over Thanksgiving again here. We see it coming.
Yes, we see it coming. Now, the one thing, there is a little bit of a buffer that the Treasury has in their Treasury general account that they keep at the Fed that has about another $600 billion, but they don't like to chew into that. They like to keep that buffer. So they have some huge decisions to make. And for me and you to look at this and say, well, her instructions are to keep this boat afloat until the election, I don't think is unreasonable to make that decision. They're spending a crap ton of money and they're trying to put perfume on a pig or whatever metaphor you want to pick to make what I believe is a weak economy when you compare it to the amount of money being spent by the federal government to try to keep things afloat. That I think that's a reasonable conclusion based on the data.
I visited a couple of pig farms. I don't think it's a bad use for perfume, actually.
Okay, good. That makes sense.
Jim, one of the things we were talking about yesterday, the panels were talking about in New York, was the length. This is the third longest inversion of a yield curve in history. Still, the two-year yield is above the 10-year yield. Sorry to be wonky, but this is such a consistent predictor of a recession. Why we're getting, and you get to the point when things go on forever that you say, well, they don't matter anymore because what you expect to happen doesn't happen. We felt that way about my grandmother, by the way. She turned 95. She had a health crisis. Then she turned 98. Then she turned 100. Then she turned 102. And you thought, okay, the woman's never going to die. She died at 106. But
that's amazing.
Yeah. And I would go talk to her and I joked with her, you know, a couple of weeks before she died. My grandmother was funny, but I mean, really, you things go on and on. And after a while, your wariness wears down.
Yeah. Which is the wrong thing to do because everybody's sitting out there going, well, we thought there was a recession coming and it wasn't. I guess we were wrong. Yeah, of course you were wrong. But let me show you the reason you were wrong. The government stepped up and absolutely hit the gas pedal in a major way of spending. We have a national debt of $34.4 trillion, and people still, like Stephen Ratner, I guess he was an economist with the Obama administration. He's talking yesterday about how great the economy is. That's fine, as long as you mention the spending. If you don't mention the spending, you're just a political hack. That belongs in the discussion, and that's the reasons we've avoided the recession are because the government took it upon themselves to single-handedly avoid the recession. And we all know how that can potentially work out if left to go on forever.
U.S. debt increase over the past 20 years has been about 7.6%, and the S&P has increased at 7.8% for the last 20 years. Yeah. Now, you want to say that's a you think it's just a coincidence? You think it's just a coincidence? You shove in a, now there's a multiplier effect. That's not a dollar for dollar thing, but
of course
there's a multiplier effect. But still, I mean, come on, folks, you shove enough. If I shove $1 billion into a dead horse, I can get him to take a lap around the track.
And right? Damn straight. And that's, I mean, what's
it's
happening.
Cause
right
and effect. It's cause and effect. We've seen it before. And so what's the greatest risk to the market? I was asked when I was in Miami to those great folks with YPO, Young Presidents Organization, great organization. Mr. Farr, what's the greatest risk? Complacency.
Yeah.
Complacency. Everybody forgets the damn thing can go down. And I've got all of these 60-year-olds going, you know, I think we should have taken on more risk last year. Can we? I feel okay about adding risk to the portfolio.
No. No,
why?
Don't do
because
it.
You haven't had your ass handed to you in about 6 or 7 years, and you forget what it feels like. And intellectually, you can say, well, yes, I know the market goes down. Really? You look at that $1 million portfolio at 792,000, and you are going to be producing Twinkies when left to your own devices.
You want? I think the biggest risk is not only enough things that are in dollar hedges, things like gold, silver, palladium, platinum, Bitcoin, whatever the hell Bitcoin is. But I have what I thought was a small amount, and now has exploded into a big amount. But these all to me are hedges. They're like a no confidence vote in the stewardship of our fiat currency, and they're all doing quite well. That being said, as I said before, I don't think the stock market is a bad thing to be in this situation, but I do think there's going to be in the short to medium term, a trimming of the hedges to kind of get the whole thing going in the stock market.
A no confidence vote.
You like that?
Stewardship of our currency. Damn, that's
yeah, right.
Brilliant.
That made me
you know,
I'm going to get a tattoo
Uriel,
that says
that's
that.
Seriously, there's your headline, pal. That's awesome. And when it comes to trimming the bushes and maintaining things, I'm going to send you a meme as soon as we get off here. And ladies and gentlemen, no, you're not going to see it. But
I love Michael Farr memes, to be clear.
I'm going to send you a meme. Jim Uriel, partner at TJM Institutional Services, the floor of the Chicago Exchange, and one of the smartest guys we ever get to talk to. Jim, thank you.
Thank you, Michael. See you guys.
We're going to be right back with Dan Mahaffey from the Dr. Scholl Foundation, also Center of the Study of the Presidency in Congress, our senior political analyst on the Farcast. We'll be right back. Please stay with us.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Farcast. Now it's time for political analyst Dan Mahaffey and your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back to the Farcast. Joining us now, as he does most every week, can't say that anymore, Dan Mahaffey from the Dr. Scholl Foundation, Center for the Study of the Presidency in Congress, and the senior political analyst on the Farcast. We're not giving that title to anybody else, Mahaffey. You're stuck with it for quite a while. Leland Vittert was on the panel yesterday in New York. Leland Vittert from News Nation sends out his war notes, and what he said then was what he repeated in his war notes and show notes yesterday. This is it. I'm going to read it. Both Donald Trump and Joe Biden are historically weak figures and candidates by every possible measure. Yet both are inexplicably convinced that the unpopularity of the other makes their re-election inevitable. I love that.
I think it's the best way to put it I've seen so far. I think what we're getting into, and I think this is where it fits back to your previous conversation, and maybe today's word is complacency, that we are now going into a political cycle where we are going to be focused so much on tearing down the other guy while trying to hide the myriad flaws of our own guy. And I say that as, not my guy or your guy, but just the partisans in general. And you'll get the sense, and I get this now being out and about Washington more and more, that the American public is going to be disappointed no matter what the outcome is in this very close, very 50-50 society. And look, usually it was the Chicago Cubs that could disappoint me in the spring and keep that disappointment going all the way through into fall. But guess what? Now politics will do it too.
I had a, I'm remembering years ago when George Bush was won the election, and I'm using air quotation marks here on the screen, folks, won the election after the Supreme Court decision versus Al Gore. And there were two lawyers in the locker room at my gym, and it was a very somber mood that next morning. They were both Democrats, and one looked up at the other and said, "You realize how bad this is, right? You realize we're totally screwed." And the other guy, without blinking or smiling, looked up and said, "No, it's really worse than that." And I was like, "Really? Wow. This is, I mean, you know, worse than totally screwed was what I was thinking." And it was everything I could do not to giggle, you know, because, I mean, it wasn't that my guy had won or anything like that, or that I appreciated the outcome. I just appreciated how funny that was. And these guys were not in the mood for funny.
Well, I think that, you know, it's true, Michael, though. It's that we're going to have a year. Ed Luce wrote about it well, great columnist in the Financial Times last week. You think of these things, like you and Jim were talking about the ballooning national debt and the number that's on. We look at the crises around the world. We look at Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, working together to make the world a more unstable place. And we're missing out on a real debate and real solutions over these things because we are now so focused on this political cycle for the rest of the year.
George Will had a great line the other night. He said they Leland Vittert actually was saying on the immigration issue, look, Donald Trump had a House, Senate, and a Republican. He had the majority and did not solve this border crisis at all, didn't solve the issue at all. And George Will just turned around and quipped immediately. He said, Donald Trump has no interest in solving any of these issues. He has every interest in exploiting every one of these issues for his political gain. He doesn't care about actually getting them done. He's just going to make himself look good on these things. I thought that was, pithy. It had a skewer of truth to it. And that's not to take away from those things that President Trump did accomplish that were very positive things. Donald Trump did some good things. See, folks, you've got to give the devil his due. You can't be 100% critic. Everything about Joe Biden is not awful. Everything about Donald Trump is not awful. I don't care what the other side says. There are good things for each of these people and each of these administrations. There are good things in there. And to be fair, I think you have to recognize them. One of the other things that Vittert says is that this immigration issue is a proxy issue. It's a proxy issue for the chaos and disorder of everything else Americans are angry about. And both political parties, along with the media, are telling Americans that they should be angry at somebody, that they and keep them whipped up. And so whether it's the illegal criminals coming across the border because crime's an issue, whether it's the funding and support of the illegal immigrants and how much money they're getting that leads to greater senses of protectionism, where why are we spending money on these people when we're not spending money on our own Americans here in the country? Why are we sending money to Ukraine? Why are we doing all of these things? But the illegal immigration issue is basically the proxy. What do you think about that, Dan?
No, I think it is. I think everything becomes a proxy for politics these days. It's not just immigration. It's down to the choice of your chicken sandwich that people now say is your political avatar that you put forward. So hyper-polarization of these issues is nothing new. And I think you see it, one, in that the number of senators who wanted to get something done on immigration but couldn't because Trump torpedoed it, that he wanted this to be an issue, even though this was the strongest bill that you could have put forward. You have certainly the economic numbers. You look at if you break down consumer confidence these days. I hear economists who no longer even bother to use some of the surveys, because if you break them down by party, you simply see that consumer confidence is now a partisan measure of the economic confidence. It simply reflects that. So these are all those trends you see, and we're not, again, as I say, not addressing the issues. You talk about the chaos around the world. I think that harms Biden, because people in times of chaos want a strong man. But I also think voters see Donald Trump as the arsonist, not the fire marshal on some of these. So the question becomes, I think, as we move into this election, and so many of these other pundits look at it too, it's the election is going to be coming down to what are known as the double haters, the people who dislike both candidates and are either going to have to be convinced to hold their nose for one person or push just not to show up in November.
I've not heard that label, but that's me.
A lot of those are former Nikki Haley voters. Yeah, a lot of those are the Nikki Haley voters. And I think here it's good to take stock of, you know, what are the red lights that each campaign is kind of going through right now, just driving through those red lights. One, I think on the Trump side, if you had to whisper a concern, it's that you've peaked too early, that this is now all the attention is going to be on him as the candidate, not just another Republican or within Republican inter-party politics. And he's going to face a lot of money issues too, not just his legal ones, but fundraising, the empty coffers at the RNC. A lot of those things are going to catch up there. So there's complacency, I think, on the Trump side, that merely the Biden weakness is going to account for all these flaws on their side. On the same side, on the Biden area, look, they hope that these economic numbers, and as Jim and you were talking about where these economic numbers are really rooted, they hope that the public starts to, again, feel that the Biden policies have worked in their favor. But when you talk to the public, and this is what I find fascinating, Biden's things like the IRA, CHIPS Act, those are all in the rearview mirror. Even though we know in Washington they're just now being implemented, in the public mind, the economy, and this is the sense I get in conversations with folks, they think the economy is doing better because Biden hasn't gotten anything done recently, not because, as they would hope in Washington and in the White House, that the public's now feeling the effect of these programs coming through.
The State of the Union tonight, I've said earlier today, has a lot at stake. If Biden nails it and really does a great job, seems humorous, sharp, pithy, makes all the right points, that secures basically Biden, makes him the secure candidate. If he really flubs it up, really falls, God forbid, has somebody rush to the prompter to get him back on place, then there seems to be enough of a wave among Democrats that they would want a different candidate. And frankly, I truly admire Joe Biden, his dedication to our country. He is a great patriot. He has devoted his life. I don't care whether you agree with his decisions or what he's done. He's devoted his life to a service in this country. So I do have great respect, but I'm not sure which I'm really hoping for, because I really don't want him to be the candidate, Dan. Does that
right? And that's, I think that's key. That's key. I want to get back to where we've looked at the data on, you know, focus groups of these double haters, as I called them. And a lot of the themes that come up in those conversations about Biden are, of course, his age, but also the argument, one, that Biden was supposed to be a transitional bridge, that he would return normalcy. But a lot of these voters, even though he kept his cards close to his chest, these voters thought that Biden would recognize the writing on the wall and have the common sense to be a one-term president. They're disappointed that he hasn't done that or didn't announce it.
Well, they should have listened to the Farcast, because when that came up, when we were talking about that and people were saying, well, Biden will be a one-term president, and he suggested maybe he'll be a one-term president, both you and I said, baloney, baloney. Nobody gets the job and agrees to leave. Nobody.
Yes.
So we warned him. Dan Farr and Mahaffey warned him. Go ahead. Sorry.
And that, with that too, it's the sense of, was this the, and again, chaos is the point here. Is Biden the one who was supposed to be the one to get us away from chaos? And again, the president, as powerful as he is not the grand wizard of Oz controlling global events. However, the perception of weakness, be it Russia's invasion of Ukraine, our withdrawal from Afghanistan, the southern border. I'm personally keeping an eye on Haiti as a situation that's going to get much worse and could see people coming to our shores. These are all things that, again, show that the world is out of control. And the public wonders, is this man the right one? Is he strong enough to be the president at a time like this?
The world out of control, and Farr and Mahaffey are out of time. Dan, thank you very much. The image of Donald Trump as arsonist, and maybe Joe Biden as the fire chief who was supposed to, you know, drag the hose and return things to somewhat cool things off and return them to normal. I don't know for the, how many of you in the audience who remember Tim Conway and Harvey Korman, when Tim Conway would play the old man. It was brilliant. He would take shuffling steps of about 2 inches. Everything was slow. And if you can imagine Tim Conway even saying, "Hello, I'm here to fight the fire."
Yeah. Well, I want to give me 30 seconds. I want to leave with this. In China, the nickname for Trump is Trump the Country Strengthener, if you translate it literally. It's sarcasm, though, because he says he's making America strong, but the Chinese say he's actually making China stronger. That's the pun there. The nickname for Biden, on the other hand, is the Sleepy King, because it seems like he's not with it, but the Chinese see him as maneuvering to create this web of countries opposed to China. It's fascinating that that exact comparison you have comedically is what the nicknames are for them in China.
Dan Mahaffey from the Dr. Scholl Foundation. We're going to be back with our friend Kenny Polcari. He was at this conference yesterday. See what he thought, what he heard, when we come back on the Farcast.
Michael Farr and the Farcast are proud to support Heroes, Inc. Heroes supports the spouses and children of law enforcement officers and firefighters who gave their lives in the line of duty to the greater Washington, D.C. community. Their singular goal is to honor the supreme sacrifice made by these individuals by caring for their families. Heroes' work begins within 24 hours of the tragic loss and continues indefinitely. We invite you to learn more about Heroes' mission at heroes.org. We hope that you will consider supporting Heroes as they endeavor to honor those who protect us. That's heroes.org. Heroes, here for you, here for good. And now, back to the Farcast and your host, Michael Farr.
We appreciate you listening into the Farcast this week. And now to introduce this week's special guest, here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. As promised, the great, the famous, the infamous, the renowned, and the much older than I am, face and voice of Fox Business News, Kenny Polcari. Welcome back, Kenny. Glad you're with us, baby.
Michael, thank you. It's always a pleasure to be back. And yes, I'm glad that I'm here with you as well as we approach both our birthdays.
Well, as
only weeks away now.
Sana's birthday and then your birthday. We got to do Ron Sana's birthday and your birthday. You know, Jack Barugian's the same age. Jack Barugian's the same age. He's within a month, too.
Oh, he's in April. Isn't he in early April, though, before you?
I don't know. Yeah, he's older than I. They're all three of you older than I am.
I think you're the baby in the group.
Yeah, I am. Forever. I love this. I get to be the baby. Ladies and gentlemen, we're all born in March and April of 1961, the four of us. So, but I'm the last birthday, April 24th. So Kenny's in 2 weeks. 1 week, 2 weeks, 2 weeks.
29th, the 29th.
Yeah, 2 weeks, yeah, 3 weeks, yeah. So, Kenny, we had this big conference yesterday. You did the big media tour in New York, as you always do, and explained to the world on Fox TV, which you do on a daily basis. Now, tell us what you listened to all of these talking heads yesterday at the Hightower Day with the Stars. What'd you think?
So listen, it was fine. It was a great conference. Everyone's got their own input about where the economy's going and what to do and, you know, what's strong and what's weak and what's JJ going to do. And I hear you, and it's all fine. But I don't think we heard anything really new based on what you and I have been discussing for the last couple of months in terms of the economy, Fed policy, how people and investors should be thinking and positioning themselves, or at least having a conversation with their advisors as we move through what's going to probably be a fairly volatile 2024.
Stephanie Link said that she was surprised. Stephanie puts on this, really organizes this whole Day with the Stars, this conference thing in New York. And there were probably 20 some odd CNBC regulars plus beyond CNBC. I mean, Kenny was there. A bunch of other folks were there. Leland Vittert was there from News Nation. So Kenny, she said she was surprised at the note of caution, that there was an underlying sense of bearishness there that I thought I encapsulated well, that I thought people with this much experience were all saying the same thing. It doesn't stay this good this long without a pullback. And we all know it. We're just trying to figure out where it's coming from and how deep it's going to be. And that seemed to be the only open question. And folks were nodding with me when I said it and told me afterwards. I mean, the other talking heads said, yeah, actually, that's it.
I think you're right. But we've talked, we've talked about this too. Look, the market had a great 2023. The first 2 months of 2024 have gotten off to a solid start, but we haven't had so much of a 3% pullback during all this time, really. And so it's been a little bit frustrating. And so I do expect, I think the tone was that, yes, they were cautious for a pullback, but I don't think anyone there yesterday spoke about, you know, a coming crash or, oh my God, we're going to correct we're going into a complete bear market of 20% plus. I don't think that was the case at all. Are people expecting a pullback within the normal trading range, which would be up to 9%? Absolutely. I'm in kind of that range where I think if we see a 5-7% pullback, I actually think that's good. It'll
sure
shake the branches a little
good.
Bit. Right. It'll shake the branches a little bit. It'll reprice, right, and revalue some stocks that have gotten well stretched. And we know what those names, they're all the tech stocks, the Magnificent Seven, all that stuff in that AI space that has really gotten, in my mind, blown out of proportion. Not that it's not important. It is here. It's here to stay. This is not a dot-com scenario like it was in 99. These are companies that actually make money, and they have a real future, unlike what we saw in 99. But let's not go there. But there are other sectors in the economy that have that not only have not been really participating, but offer opportunity. And so I think a lot of that came up yesterday. Industrial, consumer healthcare were issues. Basic materials were sectors that strategists and analysts from yesterday's conference were finding opportunity, myself included. I think industrials, financials, and energy are places that investors can look as they maybe kind of trim around the edges in some of their outperforming tech names and put that money plus maybe new money to work in some of these other sectors. But I think that was really the tone. I didn't get a sense of doom and gloom at all yesterday.
Now, there were a couple of folks. I mean, Rich Farr, my
yeah, but I discounted him. He's way out on the bell curve, so I discounted him.
Well, Barry Knapp thinks that we're gonna, and now he's one smart guy. This Barry Knapp guy, I mean, this is one smart guy. I was gonna use an inappropriate anyway, but he is. And you know, he sees a problem coming in credit in the banks, and he wouldn't own any of them. And then half the people there were saying, well, you would own the banks because this is not a huge credit issue. This is not going to be a structural credit issue. And then you saw that Community Bank of New York yesterday got bailed out at the last minute. Stock was big down, big up, big whipsaw for those who were selling yesterday. They've got to be pissed.
Right. But you know, let's talk about the Community Bank for a minute, because while, yes, their portfolio was under pressure from the real estate, people concerned about real estate and their exposure specifically, I think clearly most of the most recent weakness is due exactly to the fact that they had problems with their internal controls, which suggests something completely different. right? And so I think it's very specific to New York Community Bank. I don't think you're going to see this contagion in the regional banking sector. Now, look, the KRE was down yesterday at 1.3%. Yes, because people are fearful of the contagion. I don't, and it closed flat on the day. I don't necessarily see the contagion. Do I see this problem specific to New York Community? Yes. And then you saw Steve Mnuchin and his fund, along with three or four other funds, Citadel included, you know, coming to the rescue with $1 billion to kind of shore up and restore confidence. Well, the confidence is not about the CRE market. The confidence is about their, in my mind, their internal controls.
Yeah. All right. So, Kenny, let's wrap, bring it around for me. As we were talking on our panel, we also covered some politics, and we listened to the current political state. Give me your experience with, you've been through a lot of election cycles. What happens to the markets through these election cycles? Do these things matter or not? Are they, I mean, is this just like getting your teeth drilled for like 6 days solid at the dentist?
Yeah, but now we have 8 months. This is the first time, by the way, we've had a clear winner in both parties, and now we have 8 months to put up with this. So we're going to be getting our teeth drilled for 8 months, right? But I think what happens in a cycle like this, and it happens with every presidential cycle, is the chaos that it creates. One day, this is the conversation. The next day, this is the conversation. What do the polls say? Who's winning? Who's out? Who's in? What does that mean for policy? And so that creates some volatility and chaos, which I think that's exactly what we're going to see this year, which is why you have to be careful and don't build a portfolio around who you think the next president's going to be. You need to build a portfolio, a diversified portfolio based around where you think the opportunity is, and then taking advantage of that opportunity when the chaos comes, right? Because we both know political and geopolitical situations don't in the long term price stocks, right? It's the economy. It's how these companies perform. It's the guidance. It's the products. It's the innovation. It's the entrepreneurship that drives the value of stocks in this country.
So we're saying then we need to take a look at the numbers. We need to ignore the yelling and screaming in the fish market. Right. What did you make of the fact that next year, for the first time, we're going to see service on the debt be a bigger number than the defense budget?
Okay, that is a little bit concerning to me. But again, we've been talking about this. We all know how the budget is now spinning out of control. And to one of the, I forget who said it yesterday, when rates were down at 0%, why Janet Yellen didn't fund much longer term? You know, they talked about 50-year and 100-year bonds back then, and, you know, they poo-pooed them and all that stuff. But it is, I think that is going to be a problem. So there will be, you know, a day of reckoning. They have come to Jesus, and we're all going to have to recognize the fact that there's going to be a problem. And so there's going to be some belt tightening for sure, which is why, once again, that to me speaks to maintaining a portfolio of the biggest names in the biggest sectors you want, you know, kind of tightening it up and not going so far out on the size scale in terms of market capitalization. So I'm not afraid of owning names, big names in each one of the sectors that I kind of find opportunity. But I would be cautious.
Do your work, avoid emotion, stick with the plan.
Right.
Markets will be volatile, emotions will be more volatile.
Right.
And the long-term plan and discipline will see you through. Kenny Polcari and Farr have been saying the same thing for years and years and years. And, you know, years ago, Kenny, I've told this story before. I was on the floor of the exchange getting ready to do CNBC. I was talking to your friend, my friend, Art Cashin. And he was like, hey, how are you, pal? What are you talking about today? And I was like, they got me on Art with some hedge fund guy who was up 1,400% last year, and I'm supposed to be the slow money, boring guy. And Cashin looks at me, doesn't blink. Cashin would do this. And he goes, yeah. Good for you. He says, you remember that guy like 7 or 8 years ago, the hedge fund guy who was up like 1,500%? And I said, no. And he said, exactly. You never do, and you're not going to remember this guy in 6 months either. He walked away. And
right.
That was it. You know,
right.
Get the flash in the pan guys.
Right. A one-hit wonder, and then it comes back to normal.
And viewers and others are like, they keep having Kenny and Farr on, and they're, You know, they don't say this about you. They say it about me. You know, boring. He just does this. Well, I buy good companies. I like to hold them. I like to look for blah, 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 blah. And it's just boring. Well, guess what? Right. I'm the guy who's been there for 37 years still making money at this stuff.
That's right. And guess what? Sometimes boring is beautiful, by the way.
Boring is beautiful. There we'll go with that headline for today. Boring is beautiful. No, Harry, we can't. As soon as you put boring in the headline, nobody listens, okay? Nobody listens. Well, let's say that Kenny is beautiful. Maybe we'll go with that one. Kenny, you are beautiful. Thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it for another Farcast as we cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world, bringing you some of the best insiders we know to help us understand the world and what's going on and what difference it's going to make to us in investing in the U.S. economy. So hope it's helped. Great to be with you again this week. We'll be back again next week. Do it all again. For Harry Jennings, our producer, and everybody at Farmiller in Washington, the Farcast and Hightower Advisors, thank you. Please share us on social media. See you next week. I'm Michael Farr.
Yeah, depends on where I'm going, you know. I might be going to a couple of different places. But anyway, so go ahead. Let's go.
All right. We are rolling. Good in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome back.
That's how the second segment started too, Kenny.
Honest to God.
And again, with depth and feeling. 3, 2, 1. Thanks for joining us this week on the Farcast. We hope you enjoy the show as much as we enjoy making it for you. Thanks to our guests, Jim Murio, Dan Mahaffey, and Kenny Polcari. Farcast is produced by Michael Farr and Harry Jennings and comes to you weekly for free on all major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Google, TuneIn, and Apple Podcasts. You can stream past episodes as well as subscribe so you never miss a new one. Please be aware that anytime we or any of our guests mention a specific company, sector, or refer to performance in relation to an earnings report, a news headline, or an economics trend, it's not a recommendation to buy or sell. Review the risks and rewards of any investment with your financial advisor for what specific investment and general strategy is appropriate for you before you make any investment decision. As always, if we can be of assistance at Farmiller in Washington, please reach out to me at hjennings@farmiller.com. We are here to help, and I'm happy to arrange for any of our listeners an appointment with one of our financial professionals to review your portfolio, your needs, and your goals. We love reading all of your notes and try to reply to as many as we can. You can reach us at hjennings@farmiller.com. Let us know any questions you have about past episodes or questions you'd like us to address in upcoming shows. Please subscribe and share the show. We'll be back with you next week with a new scheduled special guest, Mike Singleton from Invictus Research, making his first podcast appearance. I had a great conversation with Mike this past week, and we're eager to share his insights, backed by dogged research, into the trajectory of the economy and markets. Take care, stay safe, and stay healthy. Thanks for listening to the Farcast, Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Farmiller in Washington is a group comprised of investment professionals registered with Hightower Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Some investment professionals may also be registered with Hightower Securities, LLC, member FINRA and SIPC. Advisory services are offered through Hightower Advisors, LLC. Securities are offered through Hightower Securities, LLC. All information referenced herein is from sources believed to be reliable. Farmiller in Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC have not independently verified the accuracy completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Farmiller in Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC, and any of its affiliates make no representations or warranties, expressed or implied, as to the accuracy or completeness of the information or for statements or errors or omissions or results obtained from the use of this information. Farmiller in Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC, and any of its affiliates assume no liability for any action made or taken in reliance on or relating in any way to the information. This podcast and the materials contained herein were created for informational purposes only.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the authors and do not represent those of Hightower Advisors LLC or any of its affiliates. Barr Miller & Washington and Hightower Advisors LLC or any of its affiliates do not provide tax or legal advice. This material was not intended or written to be used or presented in any way to any entity as tax or legal advice. Clients are urged to consult their tax and/or legal advisors for related questions.